Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coalition authorities announced today that four people were arrested in Iraq last week for the killing of American Nicholas Berg. Brigadier General Mark Kimmett says two were released and two are still in custody for questioning.
We have some intelligence that would suggest they have knowledge, perhaps some culpability, but we're not going to know until we've actually finished the questioning.
Meanwhile, several hundred prisoners were also released today from the Abu Ghraib prison, and several hundred more graphic photos and some videotape of prisoner abuse were made public by the Washington Post. This as Iraq reacts to the obvious shift in stature of a former key U.S. ally, Ahmed Shalabi. For the latest, we're joined first by Time magazine correspondent Vivian Walt on the line from Baghdad. Vivian, hi.
Hello.
Hi there. Iraqi officials say the four people arrested for the killing of Nicholas Berg are Saddam Hussein's former Fedayeen guards and not al-Zarqawi, the Jordanian accused of the actual murder. Can you confirm that, and what does that mean?
Well, actually, they say that two of them have already been released, and they're not quite sure of the other two. The other two are being kept for questioning, but what seemed kind of like a hopeful arrest just a few hours ago is beginning to seem a lot less certain. The coalition officials are now saying that only two of them look like they might have leads on who actually did it. Mm. It's highly likely that even if it was a killing by Zarqawi itself, that there would still be perhaps some link with Saddam's old Fedayeen or his young zealous fighters.
Yeah. And Vivian, initial reports said that both the Berg arrests, which may not be fruitful, and the Chalabi raid yesterday were carried out by Iraqi police, even if coalition forces were standing on the perimeter. What does that mean? Is that significant?
Well, it is in a sense. Actually, I spent some time this morning with Chalabi, and of course, you know, while the Iraqi police might have been inside his house, the Americans were outside and certainly directing things, according to him. There's certainly no doubt in his mind that this was completely engineered and directed and overseen by the Americans, and that this really is about the end of his relationship with the Americans. It is not really an internal Iraqi matter very much.
Yeah. Does it also serve the purpose, as some might say, of just letting the coalition authorities dodge questions by saying, you just have to ask the Iraqi police?
Well, they've been doing this for several months, actually, not just on the raid with Chalabi, but every time there is an incident that happens around here, we are increasingly being told to ask the Iraqi authorities about it. There has been a lot of passing the buck. Mm. Of course, the other thing that has happened in the last few days is this terrible killing of about 40 people up in northern Iraq by American helicopters. And that's another thing that coalition officials have been dodging questions on all day.
Right. So we don't have answers there. But Vivian, I want you to stay right there in Baghdad for a second. We're joined now by John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. And John, I want to ask you about Ahmed Shalabi. Briefly, his transgressions include possibly having suspicious ties with Iran, being overly critical of the U.S. coalition leaders in Iraq. But he says he's still Americans' best friend there. How is Washington reacting to his fall from grace, and is he taking anyone else with him?
I think that, Robin, everybody is still scratching their heads a bit to try to figure out what to make of this. Ironically, the fact that he seemed to be at odds and being raided by American troops is probably somewhat beneficial to Chalabi in the context of Iraqi politics. But it's another sign of how far off track this occupation has gotten since the Bush administration planned it. This is somebody who certainly the Pentagon thought was in a position to step in as a leader of post-war Iraq, and that is not happening according to plan. And it simply is another for the broader mass of Americans who don't follow these things very closely. It may be taken as another indication that the wheels are coming off this occupation.
Well, is anyone going to lose their job over it? I'm thinking of Paul Wolfowitz, who has long had ties with Chalabi before his current office, Wolfowitz's office. I mean, how is it reflecting on officials such as Wolfowitz?
I don't think that Paul Wolfowitz will lose his job over this. Don Rumsfeld doesn't seem to be going anywhere. And President Bush, remember, has not repudiated this policy. He continues to make the case that we'll complete our mission there, that we'll have a transfer of sovereignty, however messy it looks between now and June 30th. We'll have the transfer on that date. And there's no indication, though the president is going to give a nationally televised speech on Monday, there's no indication that he is changing tack on that.
Well, Vivian Walt, in Baghdad, we only have about a minute left, but I want to ask you, yesterday, Chalabi's guards were disarmed in that raid on his home. How vulnerable is he there in Baghdad? And what's the reaction been on the street to what happens to him now?
Oh, well, the arms are back. I mean, the guards are certainly armed against every house I was at that to do with Chalabi, including his own personal living quarters, was very well guarded with armed men. So that was really just a one-day thing. I mean, certainly, as John said, Robin, his credibility on the street has just soared, of course, in the last 24 hours. He didn't have a whole lot before then. And as he himself told me this morning, I can see nothing bad that has come out of this. This is actually a very good thing for me.
So I
laughed about it. So is
Ahmed Chalabi perhaps crazy like a fox? Do you think he purposely has been designing this to distance himself from the U.S., just in the few seconds we have?
If you're asking me, Robin, that question was for me, yes. I mean, I do think that he's got some very, very strong criticisms about the American occupation, some of which ring fairly true for those of us who've witnessed it over the last year.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you both for joining us.
My pleasure.
Mm. Vivian Walt.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Vivian. As always, Vivian Walt, correspondent for Time Magazine. She spoke to us from Baghdad. John Harwood is national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. We spoke to him in Washington.
As campaigning begins for September elections in Hong Kong, a third radio talk show host has resigned, saying he could not express his opinions freely. Alan Lee's program was called Storm in a Teacup. He had been filling in for the previous host, who left suddenly for Europe on May 2nd after he received death threats and his trading company was vandalized. Lee also stepped down as the Hong Kong delegate to China's parliament. Well, joining us on the line from Hong Kong is managing editor of the Asian Wall Street Journal, Peter Stein. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you, Gail.
Peter, there seems to be a pattern here. We have three pro-democracy radio talk show hosts quitting suddenly within the past month, death threats, vandalism to their businesses, pro-democracy lawmakers complaining of harassment. Is this politics as usual in a campaign season, or is there something else going on here?
I think it's fair to say, Gail, that we've reached a certain critical mass of events happening in Hong Kong that suggests the political climate here has gotten a lot stormier than it has been in past months or even in past years. And it's definitely a sign of the fact that there's a lot of concern among the pro-Beijing camp in Hong Kong and also in Beijing itself about what's going to happen in the elections here come September.
Well, tell us a little bit more about this program, Teacup in the Storm. I've seen it described on the web as a place where people would essentially call up and rant.
Yeah, that's a fair description. You know, there are people who say it's kind of like the Don Imus of Hong Kong, or some people have called Albert Cheng sort of a Michael Moore of Hong Kong, one of the previous radio hosts who stepped down. But it's a very special program in Hong Kong. You have to bear in mind that Hong Kong media has come under a lot of political pressure over the last few years. The newspapers and magazines have largely toned down their criticism of China and have really tread a very careful and fine line in trying to report on anything that would be sensitive. But the radio is one area of the media that has remained fairly vibrant. And this show has been one of the most popular over the last few years. It's a show where they talk about largely about local politics, and a lot of the calls are, frankly, complaints.
Well, tell us a little bit about Mr. Lee. He is important not just as a radio host.
That's right. The other two radio hosts who left their jobs in the last couple of weeks are people who've been in the media business for a while. They're quite well-known personalities, and they're fairly known for having fairly strong views both about the Hong Kong government and also about generally Beijing's role in Hong Kong politics. Alan Lee is a little bit different from the others because he's a longtime political figure of good standing in Hong Kong. In some ways, he's very much a member of the Chinese establishment in Hong Kong. He was a member of the National People's Congress, which is China's lawmaking body, and was on good terms with a lot of people from different parts of the political spectrum. So this is not a bomb thrower.
And what did he have to say about his resignations, both from the talk show and from Congress?
He said that this was a personal decision, but that he made this after getting a number of signals of pressure on him as a result of his work on the radio. He was getting phone calls, he said, from people who had not given him phone calls before, including people in China. He said people who were good friends of his, who he used to talk with every day, were no longer returning his phone calls. And he said that it was clear what was going on. He was coming under a lot of pressure over the fact that he was hosting this very controversial show. He felt that he thought the message was quite clear, and that to continue in this job would basically entail a life that he didn't want to lead. He also said that as a representative of Hong Kong and the National People's Congress, he felt that he was not really effective in doing what he felt that he needed to do, which was to represent Hong Kong's opinions and to try and affect change.
And Peter, how is the Chinese government responding to the resignations and to those allegations of harassment?
There's been no comment from any Chinese officials. The only folks who've come out to comment in an official way are the Hong Kong government. A Hong Kong government spokesman came out a few days ago to say that freedom of press was alive and well in Hong Kong, and that the Hong Kong government was determined to continue to support freedom of journalists.
Perhaps a matter of opinion.
Yeah, that's right.
Peter, thank you.
You're welcome, Gail.
Peter Stein is managing editor of the Asian Wall Street Journal. He joined us from Hong Kong.
Just ahead, the new export, money. Immigrants make it here and send much of it home. Good news for the economies of the U.S. and Latin America.
And later in the program, actress turned singer Esther Ballant.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
A new study shows that money earned by Latin American immigrants in the U.S. has a dramatic effect on the economy, both here and in the workers' home countries. It's the first time that the effects of immigrant labor have been examined in such detail, and it demonstrates that the money sent back to home countries is a major hedge against poverty in Latin America. Roberto is from the Brazilian town of Valadares. He works at a gas station in Boston.
Most of Brazilians will got two jobs because they want to send money home. But if you don't work hard, you're not going to send any money. All the money is going to stay right here in the U.S. So let's say if I make $2,500, I'll say $500 for rent, $500 I'll send money home. I have five brothers here. No, we all send money home to do constructions, you know, buy a house, farm.
He sends money home, but he's also putting away savings in an American bank for himself.
I'm 36 years old now. In 26, I'll be 62. So if I retire, I want to go home. And I have a daughter here. So after I take care of my daughter, make sure she has a place to stay, maybe buy a house, farm. I want to buy a farm in Brazil.
Roberto says back in Valladares, there are rows of travel agencies and banks with long lines of customers picking up money being sent from relatives in the U.S. And that money has fueled a building boom.
Like my town in Brazil where I live, yeah, there's a lot of new buildings in my town where I came from, called Valladares. There's a lot of new construction, and most of the money comes from USA. Yeah, they send millions and millions of dollars a year.
Donald Terry led the study on these funds, known to economists as remittances, for the Inter-American Development Bank. He joins us on the line from New York. Welcome, Donald.
Good afternoon.
There is much of this story that seems very familiar, you know, men and women striking out, settling into new countries, sending money back home to the relatives. So what is new about these findings?
Well, I think what's new about these findings is the scale and the scope. I mean, the term remittances, which is the money that people who move from one country to another and then send back home to their families out of their earnings, that's been around for a long time. But what's interesting now is that the forces of a globalized economy are increasing this phenomenon. And so you've got really at this point the Western Hemisphere is an integrated labor market in which there are jobs in the United States, and people from Latin America are increasingly moving here to take those jobs. That benefits the people back home in Latin America, but it also benefits the American economy as well because these people are filling the jobs in desperately needed pieces of the American economy.
When does the sending back of money begin, and how long does it continue?
Well, typically, there's not much that's sent home in the first year because people are just getting settled. But starting in the second year and peaking in the third year, people start sending home a considerable portion of their own income. And that really continues for a good number of years.
It's interesting to note that two newspapers this week reported very differently on your findings. The Financial Times said that migrants are sending more money home, and the Wall Street Journal wrote that migrants are spending more money here in the U.S. So which is it?
Well, I laughed when I read those headlines the next day. It's both. I think that's just a different way of looking at numbers. But we don't want it to be understood that most of the money that the Latin American immigrants to the United States make is leaving the United States. It certainly is not. The total amount is about $30 billion a year that's going home to Latin America. That typically is about 10% of the average earnings of the Latin American working in the United States. But for the recipient back home, it's critical. For the recipient back home, it's typically 50 to 80% of the income of that household. And so without these funds, really, they would be living in abject poverty. On the other hand, the total amount of earnings of Latin American immigrants in the United States is about $450 billion. And so, yes, $30 billion goes out, but $420 billion stays in the United States and is used with a multiplier effect to contribute to the economies throughout the United States.
And so even if they are not here legally, they're still contributing to the economy of the U.S. by paying other taxes?
Well, not only are they contributing to the economy, but, of course, they pay sales taxes. And even if they are undocumented, typically they are paying Social Security taxes, withholding taxes for which they will never receive a benefit. And so every study that I have ever seen indicates that Latin American immigrants pay more in taxes than they receive in benefits.
Is what you're saying then that immigrants spend about 90% of their income here in the United States and send about 10% of it back to their home country?
That's correct. But for the people who are doing the sending, this is still an enormous sacrifice. The average person who is sending money back home is making $20,000 a year. So to take 10% of that and send it back home is an enormous sacrifice. We estimate, although we don't work outside of Latin America and the Caribbean, the estimates are that there is probably about $150 to $175 billion a year being sent around the world. And so we're talking about literally 100 million people sending but supporting 400 to 500 million people. Almost one out of every 10 people on Earth are involved in the remittances function. And what's amazing to me is that until quite recently, this phenomenon was literally hidden in plain view. Yes, we knew about it. But because the people who send and the people who receive are more or less marginalized in their societies, and because the amounts of money that they were sending were typically $100 or $200 or $300 at a time, it really wasn't counted. But now it's being discovered. And for instance, next month, when the heads of states of the major developed countries called the G7 meets in Sea Island, Georgia, for the first time, remittances will be on the agenda. 5 years ago, heads of states, finance ministers, foreign ministers wouldn't have known what the word remittances was for the most part. And now it's on the agenda starting next month. So this is an enormous breakthrough in terms of this issue.
Donald, thank you.
Okay, you're quite welcome.
Donald Terry led the study on remittances for the Inter-American Development Bank.
Next week on Here and Now, President Bush addresses the Army War College. We'll have a report.
And we talk to actor Mario Van Peebles, who honors his father, Melvin, by making a movie about him.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
In Massachusetts, the average price of pump-it-yourself regular gasoline is $2.03 a gallon. But that sounds like a bargain to Californians who are shelling out $2.31 a gallon. Whatever they're paying at the pump these days, drivers have a lot to say about why they think prices are so high, as well as what they're doing about it. Here's a sampling from the streets of Boston.
I just think we have an overconsumption on a certain type of fuel, and we haven't really spent any time exploring alternative resources, and I think we really need to do that.
This whole world is using more gas, more energy. Everybody driving their SUVs.
Not looking at developing alternative resources, and I may buy myself a little electric car next.
Oh, well, I think we can blame it almost directly on the whole war in Iraq.
I think that our country does consume a ridiculous amount of oil.
Have the rising gas prices affected the way that you drive?
No. I have to go to work far. I just happen to, as bad as they are, I just go where I have to go.
No, I only drive about once a month because I live two blocks from work, so it hasn't bothered me.
No, not really. But I'm rural, so I don't have a lot of choice in the matter.
I think that it perhaps has affected the amount of times that I leave the city because primarily I only drive in the city. But things like day trips out, I've been more reluctant to, you know, look outside of kind of my own area.
Definitely will impact whether or not I decide to take trips in my car over the summer. I don't think we'll be doing that, but I'll still be driving to work.
Gas prices have not affected my driving that much yet because in general I try to drive as little as possible. Too much traffic, too much pollution, and too much money to spend for gas.
As prices at the pump soar to the highest they've been in 23 years, attorneys general from seven states, all Democrats, are demanding answers. The chief law enforcement officers from Arkansas, Connecticut, California, Iowa, Minnesota, New York, and Rhode Island are calling on President Bush to direct an international investigation into how those prices are set. Here's Attorney General Mike Hatch of Minnesota during a conference call yesterday.
Is it the war? Is it just simply greed? Is it price opportunism by the oil companies? Whatever it is, in order to have a complete investigation, you got to have the national administration involved.
Well, for more now on whatever it is, war, greed, gouging, or perhaps something else entirely, we turn to Sterling Burnett, senior fellow with the National Center for Policy Analysis. He joins us from Dallas, Texas. Welcome, Sterling.
Good to be on.
Can you help us out here with a simple explanation of what the federal government might be able to achieve with an international investigation, and is that the way to go?
Well, I think that the federal government already knows largely why the gas prices are so high. I think this is largely a political stunt by Democratic attorneys general to embarrass the president. The gas prices are high because, A, China is growing rapidly. B, the U.S. also has a growing economy. But China is taking 40% of the new production. In the U.S., at least, our gas prices are reflected more than the barrel of oil price. It's reflected by refining capacity. And we have shrinking refining capacity due to environmental laws, some economic concerns of the companies that own the refineries, and most importantly, the need to formulate different kinds of gasolines for different areas, which limits overall capacity for any one type of fuel. These are environmental regulations. They increase the price of gas.
Well, speaking of refineries, Sterling, several of the attorney generals yesterday mentioned recent increases in profits by oil refineries. Here's Attorney General Terry Goddard of Arizona.
Consumers in Arizona are literally being crushed, consumers and small businesses, by this increase in gas prices. And it appears that refinery profits, as Attorney General Lockyer just said, are exorbitant.
Well, what about that, Sterling? Are these profits exorbitant or not?
The refineries are, except for the retail outlet, are the lowest profit margin area in the petroleum pipeline. Less than a 5% profit margin on average, which is lower than you'll get almost on bonds if you use them as an investment. So if they're making a little more now, I'm not too upset about it. One of the reasons that people aren't building more refineries is because there's no profit in it. If refineries start making some money, we'll get more refineries. More refineries means lower gas prices because we'll be able to refine more fuel.
What do you make of some calls to take some oil from the strategic oil reserves? Is that just delaying the day of judgment here when price hikes are going to be inevitable instead of solving the problem?
Once again, it's a political maneuver. It would do nothing to reduce the price of gasoline at the pump. President Clinton tried this in 2000. He released 30 million barrels of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which we had to buy back at a higher price. But when he released it, the price of the pump went down about 1 cent over the next 3 months. So it's a quick fix. If you really want long-term price stability, if you really want to reduce gasoline prices, you have to increase, A, domestic supplies. And there are ways of doing that, but the very people who are calling for investigations and who are calling to release the strategic, oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, they're the same ones that are blocking new production on federal lands in the U.S. We also, as technology changes over time, will become more efficient. Right now, consumers are already responding to the price at the pump. SUV sales are declining, and smaller car sales are going up. That is going to reduce the demand for gasoline, and when the demand goes down, the prices will go down.
It's also interesting to note that the Europeans would look at $2 or so a gallon and say, great, let me sign up for that, because they've been paying much more than we have for years.
Yeah, but in fairness, the Europeans pay more because they have much higher taxes on fuels. Right now, a lot of people complain about the taxes on our fuels, and I personally think that gasoline and petroleum products are taxed at too high a rate compared to other products that we purchase. However, in Europe, more than half to two-thirds, depending on the country you go to, of the price of fuel is just taxes.
Do you see any signs that prices might be coming down soon? Obviously, this is the start of the big travel season.
Well, the truth is the summer driving season isn't typically terribly bad for the U.S. We have higher prices generally during the start of the winter when you have the fuel oil season and you have to switch refinery capacity over to fuel oil. I think that fewer people will be driving this year, and when they drive, they'll take shorter they'll take vacations closer to home. Probably air travel will be down. These will all be reflected in reduced demand, which will lower the prices somewhat.
Thank you, Sterling.
Thank you.
Sterling Burnett is Senior Fellow at the National Center for Policy Analysis. He joined us from Dallas, Texas.
Still to come, the music of Esther Ballant. You may remember her as the young immigrant in Jim Jarmusch's 80s film classic Stranger Than Paradise.
You're listening to Here and Now.
The NBA Conference Finals this weekend should have plenty of drama. In the West, the Minnesota Timberwolves have overcome a string of first-round losses to reach the finals against the Los Angeles Lakers, whose superstar Kobe Bryant is on trial for rape and squeezing in games between court appearances. In the East, coach Rick Carlisle and his Indiana Pacers face the Detroit Pistons, the team that fired Carlisle last year after two winning seasons and after being named 2002's Coach of the Year. Well, Indiana coach Rick Carlisle joins us on the line now. He's got his game face on. Hi, Rick. And when I say you have your game face on, I'm picturing Gary Cooper at high noon.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not quite old enough to remember Gary Cooper.
But how are you feeling about facing the team that fired you?
You know, it's interesting. It presents a lot of challenges, and certainly there'll be a lot of intrigue and a lot of talk. But when it comes right down to it, it's really about basketball and what goes on out on the floor.
So. Yeah, but it's also about nerves. You're walking into this building. Of course, you've played in Detroit during the regular season, but this is the arena where a guard tried to prevent you from going to your own firing press conference after you were fired. Is that a true story?
Well, our business is full of ironies, and that is a true story, and one that's a little out of the ordinary. But they have to come in our building first. We'll open up here at Conseco Fieldhouse tomorrow night, and we look forward to the challenge.
Well, we need a blackboard here to explain to people who aren't following the game. You were fired by Detroit, replaced by Larry Brown. You were snapped up by your old teammate and coaching partner, Larry Bird, who's now GM at Indiana. He fired Isaiah Thomas, hired you. A little bit later, the New Jersey Nets fired Byron Scott, hired the untested Larry Frank. You know, much is being made of this series being a justification of the hiring and firing decisions of the last few years. How much pressure is that on you?
None, really. It's really, I don't view this playoff series as any means for justification or validation or anything else.
Really? Even if it's your friend Larry Bird and you want to sort of
show? Don't misunderstand. We are in this thing to win. Mm-hmm. But anything involving the coaches, really is more of a subplot.
Yeah.
What can you do? You got to move on and look forward to the future.
Well, let's do that. Let's look at the upcoming series. Detroit clobbered the Nets last night. Do they have the extra incentive of wanting to beat their former coach, or do you think that's not going to be a factor? How do you think that?
Oh, I'm sure they're going to want to win, the same way we're going to want to beat them. And the other thing that plays into this, they got to this point last year, or should I say we got to this point last year when I was with them, and we got beaten. And so, their season has been built on getting beyond that point. So they're going to be very motivated. And, it's important for our guys to understand the opportunity that's been presented here.
Rick, one last question. Bruce Hornsby himself, the great piano player, has lauded your piano playing. What will you be playing tonight?
I don't know. The one song I don't have a whole lot of time to play piano, but my daughter was born exactly 2 weeks ago today, and when I was in the delivery room, the doctor that was doing the delivery always has music on. And the song that was playing was Rocket Man by Elton John, so I've been working on that.
Well, that's the big deal of the season. Rick, thanks so much.
Robin, a pleasure.
Everything else is frosting. Rick Carlisle, coach of the Indiana Pacers. They begin their playoff series against his former team, the Detroit Pistons, tomorrow night in Indiana. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
20 years ago, then 15-year-old Esther Ballant landed the role of a lifetime. She played Ava, a Hungarian immigrant with a taste for screaming Jay Hawkins, in Jim Jarmusch's indie cult classic Stranger Than Paradise.
Not that.
Screaming Jay.
Oh, that's awful.
You're the same. He's my main man.
Shoot some fire.
Yeah, I like this.
You like this stuff?
Thank you, Eddie. Back me up.
Stranger Than Paradise, with Esther Ballant as Ava, John Lurie as Willie, and Richard Edson as Eddie, road tripping from New York's East Village to Florida. A kind of city meets country. And that describes the music Ballant has been making since then. Hungarian-born in real life, a performer in her Bohemian parents' storefront theater before she was 16, Esther Ballant ultimately switched her focus from movies to music. Her latest CD is titled Mud. It's been called Americana Gone Bad, or Lucinda Williams after a stint in Prague.
Here we are, so close to heaven, having a good look around, searching for a single joy, searching for
the song Here We Are from Esther Ballant's new CD, Mud, and musician and actress Esther Ballant joins us from Carnegie Hall Studios in New York City. And welcome, Esther.
Thank you.
Now, when you hear a portion of Stranger Than Paradise, what happens to you?
Well, I feel like this weight. No. this weight that's been following me around for half my life.
More than
half my life,
but
actually.
It's still a cult classic. Does that surprise you?
Yeah, but, you know, I've also, the other side of that coin that I just mentioned, the weight, mm-hmm. is that it's actually been so long now that I can really appreciate it again, too. And I know why people like it, because it's really good.
Yeah, and it was another, completely other lifetime for you. You were 15.
Yes.
When you played that role. How different are the two people, one that I'm talking to, the one we heard on the film?
Well, I think I've lived a lot, and I've learned a lot. So I'm much more evolved, but I think there's also some essential streaks in most people that are, hopefully, if they're true to themselves, they're just kind of there always. So I still feel like not completely disconnected from that part of me. Mm-hmm. I was a much bigger brat then, though. I've calmed down.
Well, you also had a much stronger Hungarian accent. Was that your accent, or were you acting it?
It was. I think I probably did have a stronger accent then, but I also put it on for that role.
And the role was huge. And we're going to move on, as you did, to your music in a moment. But what happened? I mean, I understand that it was very frustrating after that film because it was such a huge success, and yet it was hard for you to get other roles in the film business.
Well, it was hard, but I also didn't try hard enough, probably. I'm not sure if I had 100% commitment. I mean, the whole film, movie, theater, acting thing, there are things that sort of came my way. They're not really things that I sought out to begin with. But nevertheless, I did want to participate in more films after that, and I did in a few. But good roles and good films are scarce, as you know.
Well, if you start with Jim Jarmusch and Stranger Than Paradise, you know, yes, it's going to be difficult to find anything to match that. Let's explain how that did fall your way. You were born in Hungary. Your parents were part of an experimental theater group, which traveled around Europe and ended up in the States, right next to the Chelsea Hotel in New York City.
That's right.
And you performed with them in the storefront, this sort of bohemian life, but also I guess you were seen performing by Jim Jarmusch.
That's right. We did a bunch of plays, and yeah, so I grew up kind of with high standards, and then Stranger Than Paradise happened, and so it was sort of really hurting my stomach to go audition for sitcoms after that. It was giving me a profound, nauseous feeling. So that's partially why things didn't really happen for me, but also, just to get back to that point, I think something about that movie, everybody's so sort of real in it and themselves, that people saw me as this little girl immigrant off the boat character, and that role isn't necessarily so much in demand.
That's right. But that
pigeonholing thing.
But that film and that life that you lived, I feel I can still hear it in your music now.
Oh.
Do you like looking for trouble under pebbles and stones? Just keep on talking, talking fools. What a conversation to start the day. Making sounds, but I can't hear what you say. Somewhere in the middle, the rocks shine, won't stop pouring, going out.
Esther Balance, Pebbles and Stones from her new CD, Mud. Esther, you know, we talked a little bit about the frustrations after starring in Stranger Than Paradise of, you know, trying to find another role to match that one. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if now, you know, a couple decades later, you're thinking, you know what? Everything, the growing up in Hungary, the touring Europe with parents, the living the bohemian life, the starring in a film when I'm 15, it's all coming together now in the music.
Well, it's all coming together like everything in one's life comes together. I think I've actually kind of become more myself than, like I said, a lot of those things. The theater, the traveling, the movies kind of came my way. That's not to put a negative to it, because a lot of life just comes one's way, right? But the music is something that I've sort of actually come to really truly on my own without any happenstance. So all that craziness is part of my makeup and part of who I am, and I'm sure it does show up in the music, but I think I've also kind of honed in on my essence.
Big black beast in the middle of the night, came to attack now I'm alright. Chase me, flew all around the room.
I want to quickly mention, just to add to that, your parents' theater doubled as a nightclub. You DJed there on occasion, and boy, it seemed like everyone who was anyone in the downtown scene was there. Sun Ra, the Lounge Lizards. Who were your other influences when you were finding your essence back then?
Well, what was great about it, it wasn't one kind of music. A lot of blues bands played there. DNA, the whole, like, no-wave scene.
And you were 15.
And I was 15, and I thought this was normal life, mind you.
Do you still keep in touch with Jim Jarmusch or John Lurie, your co-star in Stranger Than Paradise?
Yes. Jim, I just saw recently, and John, I speak to quite frequently.
They're a little Ava, all grown up.
John still tortures me, saying, I've known you since you were 12. Every year it gets younger and younger. Pretty soon it's going to be like he's known me since I was 5.
Well, Esther Balint, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Her new CD is called Mud. For more information, visit our website, here-now.org.
I just want to take myself to the end of the trail. I'm gonna take the sky with me, take the moon and the air. And if you have the mind, don't bother to say, please don't get out of your car. Show me a better way.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Metzen, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Thomas Terry. Our web producer is Zach Christo. And our intern is Nick Weiss Richmond.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.